going to read this morning from chapter 12, canto 1, Birth of Emperor Parikshit. The topic of the Pandavas plays a big part of this first canto. The first three chapters are the summary of the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. Those six questions, six answers. After hearing the six answers, Shaunaka wants to hear about Krishna. And Shukadeva Goswami began speaking about Krishna by speaking about the Pandavas. Prabhupada comments, wants to hear about Krishna. But those who are in relation to Krishna, the devotees, very confidential devotees like the Pandavas, that's also Krishna Katha. Hear about the attempts Krishna makes to leave Hastinapur, the Brahmastra of Ashwatthama. Here, again, this morning we're going to hear about the Brahmastra of Ashwatthama. And Krishna protecting the child. We hear about Arjuna pursuing Ashwatthama and making his decision about killing, not killing. To hear, they want to hear how Maharaj Parikshit and Shukadeva Goswami met, which is answered in the final chapter. It is said that Maharaj Parikshit is a first class devotee of the Lord, and that his birth and activities are all wonderful. Please tell us about him. So that's his birth and his activities. The birth of Emperor Parikshit is described in this chapter. He was a great emperor and possessed of all opulences of his acquired kingdom. He was so exalted that he increased the prestige of the Pandu dynasty. Why did he give up everything to sit down on the bank of the Ganges and fast until death? There are many questions asked about Maharaj Parikshit, and as a great devotee of the Lord, why did he want to give up everything, including his life? So, the topics of the Bhagavatam are not obviously necessarily chronological, but they certainly make sense in the composition. So this chapter is now returning to those questions asked in chapter 4 or in chapter 12. At least some of those questions are addressed here. Krishna's leaving Hastinapur, Krishna's entering into Dwaraka. That's just been immediately described. And so now we're back at the sages asking Sutta about the Lord being, Lord rescuing Maharaj Parikshit from the Brahmastra weapon. How was the great Emperor Parikshit, who was a highly intelligent and great devotee, born in that womb that was partially destroyed? How did his death take place? What did he achieve after his death? So, to introduce that subject, Sutta starts speaking about Maharaj Yudhisthira. Maharaj Yudhisthira played a very important role in the Namakarana ceremony. So his glories are described because the grandson, it's already said, expanded the glories of the Pandavas, his grandfathers. And so the opulence of Maharaj Parikshit, the unflinching devotion of Maharaj Parikshit, the detachment of Maharaj Parikshit, the perfect executor of Dharma, the various glories of Maharaj Parikshit are identified. Something that fits in completely with our discussion last night. When the discussion about Emperor Yudhisthira begins, Emperor Yudhisthira administered generously to everyone during his reign. He ministered generously to everyone primarily by just his being who he was. He administered his piety, that he inspired others to become pious. And from his piety and their piety, they had bountiful necessities. It wasn't just by heavily taxing his population and distributing the wealth of that taxation. He just was so pious that immediately, the citizens were well off. They shared in the piety of their king. They followed his piety, and by the strength of his dharmic quality, they followed Dharma. In that way, he was administering generously. He was exactly like his father. No mention. In one sense, his father was Pandu. In another sense, more literally, his father was Yamaraj. And in either case, they were both perfectly dharmic and very generous. He had no personal ambition and was freed from all sorts of sense gratification because of his continuous service unto the lotus feet of Lord Sri Krishna. Now Prabhupada explains, right immediately he goes into purport to quoting from the introduction to the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. There is a need for the science of Krishna in human society, for all the suffering humanity of the world. And we simply request the leading personalities of all nations to take to the science of Krishna for their own good, for the good of society, and for the good of all people of the world. There's several reading this specifically because it resonates with our discussion last night. The science of Krishna part, Prabhupada was emphasizing that there has to be proper knowledge. You have to be heading in the right direction. You can be very sincerely going in the wrong direction. So one needs proper direction. And so the science of Krishna is there. How much sacrifice Prabhupada made personally to provide the Srimad Bhagavatam and literatures. He spoke, but he also, many hours each day he spoke, but he also provided Srimad Bhagavatam and so many other books, the science of Krishna. And he understood well, here we're getting an insight into how he saw the work that he was doing, this complete dedication to providing the science of Krishna to others. It's people are suffering for want of, they're in ignorance. They don't know what is good for them and how to achieve it. So Prabhupada is here imploring the leaders of nations, because leaders means they have followers. And if the leaders do, the followers will do. If the leaders are heading in the wrong direction, the followers are going to head in the wrong direction. So good direction is necessary, and then by so doing it'll be good for themselves, good for society, good for people in general all over the world. Like Bhakti Siddhanta gave his instruction to Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada became a leader, not a head of a nation, but a spiritual leader. And each one of us, presently, and more surely in course of time as our lives unfold, some persons will be influencing. Will be in certain ways, different according to how our lives manifest themselves, but will be setting example, giving leadership to others. And taking very seriously the science of Krishna, it's not just an academic affair. Science has its theoretical part, but it also has its practical application part. What you learn in the textbook, and then you go to the laboratory and you apply it, applied science. So the science of Krishna is both what we understand, is also what we do practically. That's science. But because Maharaj Yudhisthira was such a scientist, he knew and he did Therefore, he was detached. Detached from any consideration of sense gratification, from any personal ambition, from any sense of pride over all of his wealth and all of his attainments, and even pride in his piety itself. He didn't have those contaminations of heart. Once again, how is that possible? Continuous service unto the lotus feet of Lord Sri Krishna. He applied science, was unbroken. He knew what to do, and he was applying himself. The science of Krishna was in his grasp, and he applied it and applied it and applied it. All of the other anomalies and contaminations, they didn't, they were unknown to Maharaj Yudhisthira. They were not to be found in his life. So, science of Krishna or transcendental knowledge is necessary. So, Sutta goes on describing his opulence and opulence and opulence. Even the denizens of the heavenly planets, they were aspiring for his opulence, but he didn't care for any of that. He was, why? He was absorbed in service of the Lord. There was nothing that could satisfy him except the Lord's service. This is Vyavasayatmika Buddhi. His intelligence didn't waver. His determination didn't move around. It was fixed. That's where the class has ended at the Chicago Temple, and I'm going to cover a few more. I'm going to cover 7, 8, 9. The subject abruptly switches. There were questions about Maharaj Parikshit. He speaks about Maharaj Yudhisthira, and in introducing the birth ceremony, there's a little bridge topic. That is the glories of Maharaj Parikshit and the glories of the loving relationship that Supreme Personality of Godhead has in relation to Maharaj Parikshit. In other words, that even before he was born, he appeared before him. Maharaj Parikshit saw him. The Lord protected him. Very, very confidential and intimate exchange, even before his birth. Which gives us a hint at his very unique and glorious position. O son of Bhrigu, Sutta is speaking to Shonaka. Shonaka Rishi is the son of Bhrigu. Bhrigu Nandana. When the child Parikshit, great fighter, was in the womb of his mother, Uttara, who was suffering from the burning heat of the Brahmastra thrown by Ashvatthama, he, Maharaj Parikshit, could observe the Supreme Lord coming to him. The Prabhupada explains the 7 months, first 7 months in the womb of the mother, the child is in a state of deep sleep. Susupti, and is not exhibiting external consciousness. Consciousness is certainly there because the soul is there, but it, deep sleep is a state of consciousness where external awareness is not evidenced. Like under anesthesia, somebody can cut you up and you don't feel it because consciousness is so covered. Or during the period of cosmic annihilation, long for the whole duration of Brahma's life, the night of Brahma, consciousness is in its susupti state. It's also for the first 7 months that the child is in the womb. Now, medical science may not be able to detect it, and therefore they think there is no life, but there's life. There's soul, which means there's life, and there's consciousness, but it's a certain state of consciousness. I suppose they could deduce by their expert logic that just as you can't detect consciousness in a child within the womb, so when somebody's under anesthesia, they're also, you can't detect consciousness, so you can kill them too. Because there's no evidence of consciousness. They don't do that, anyway. But after 7 months, his consciousness entered another stage where there was external awareness, and in that state of external awareness, that's when the Sashvatthama Brahmastra was released, and Maharaj Parikshit, while within the womb, was struck by the Brahmastra. He was feeling the burning heat of the Brahmastra because he was a great fighter by nature. He was able to endure the heat, and the Lord appeared within the womb of his, by his all-powerful energy, and the child could see that someone else had come to save him. Not only someone else, but he saw the Lord in his Paramatma feature. He, the Lord, was only thumb high, but he was all transcendental. He had a very beautiful, blackish, infallible body, and he wore a dress of lightning yellow and a helmet of blazing gold. Thus he was seen by the child. Now obviously it's not a gold, like some golden ornament, but it's a transcendental feature of his paraphernalia. The Lord was enriched with four hands, earrings of molten gold, and eyes blood red with fury. As he loitered about, this is Dirgha, he stayed for some time. Wasn't loitering about like some thieves on the corner or something. He loitered about. He remained in this position with his club constantly encircling him like a shooting star. Maybe something like they do these animated things of atoms revolving around, electrons revolving around atoms. His club was moving so fast. It was creating a counter heat to counter the heat of the Brahmastra. So, in the purport, Prabhupada is assessing how the Lord appeared. By what manner did he appear? And he starts by explaining that in Brahma Samhita, there is one verse in which it is said that the Supreme Lord, Govinda, by his plenary portion, enters into the halo of the universe and distributes himself as Paramatma, or the Super Soul, not only within the heart of every living entity, but also within every atom of the material elements. Does anybody know what that verse is from Brahma Samhita? Dantarasta paramanachayantarasta. How does it start? Eko piso chanitam jagadam dakoti. It's different. So, your Brahma Samhita? Yasaurachayatam jagadanda kotim yat chaktirasti jagadanda chayaya gantaha andantarasta paramarachayantarastam govindamani purusham tamaham bhajami. He is an undifferentiated entity, so for every atom and every spirit soul within this universe, that's a number that you can't count. But there's still one Paramatma, he's an undifferentiated living entity. And in another way that he's undifferentiated, that those potencies, the atoms, as well as the souls, they're his potency. And there's no difference between the potency and the possessor of the potency, and then he enters into the potency. It's mind-boggling. In his work of creation of millions of worlds, his potency remains inseparable. All the universes exist in him, and he's present in his fullness in every one of the atoms that are scattered throughout the universe at one and the same time. Andantarasta paramanochayantarasta. So he's already there. It's Govinda. It's a portion, plenary portion of Govinda. And the matter is already there, and he expands himself within every atom and within the heart of every living entity. So he's already there. Thus the Lord is all-pervading by his inconceivable potency. He's all-pervading by his inconceivable potency in two ways. His energies are everywhere. So, because of the undifferentiated nature, the absolute nature of the Lord, he's everywhere through his energies. But he's also everywhere by his own energy. He expands himself within those energies. So the all-pervasiveness of the Lord is there by the expansion of his energy and by the expansion of himself personally. And his Brahman feature is another all-pervasive feature of himself. this energy is resting in Brahman. Thus the Lord is all-pervading by His inconceivable potency, and thus He entered the womb of Uttara to save His beloved Maharaj Parikshit. So, question. The form of Paramatma, thumb-sized Paramatma. Where did this Paramatma come from? Did it come from the heart of Maharaj Parikshit? Did it come from Uttara's heart? Did it come from one of the adjacent atoms? Or some other option? Where did it come from? It's a trick question. He's already there. Didn't have to come from anywhere. He's already there. He manifested himself. Now, for us to come into the room so we can be seen, we have to come in through one of the entrances. It's either this one, that one, or that one, and or through one of the windows, but we can't just come into the room. Just, voila. But Krishna can. He was already there, but he just made himself manifest. It's like the question, how many Paramatmas are there in the room here? There's one. So from where Paramatma manifested himself is a misleading question. He's all-pervading. He just made himself visible. So he was an act of mercy to Maharaj Parikshit. He could have protected him without showing his form. He can do anything he wants. So, what he wanted was to show his form. Very intimate act of loving reciprocation. He entered the womb of Uttara to save his beloved devotee Maharaj Parikshit. In the Bhagavad Gita 9:31, the Lord assured everyone that His devotees are never vanquished. What is that verse? Huh? Kauteya Pratijanihi Nami Bhakta Pranashyati. The devotees never destroyed, never vanquished. What does that mean? No one can kill a devotee of the Lord because he is protected by the Lord. And no one can save the person whom the Lord desires to kill. Does this mean devotees never die? Or, there's a battle and the devotee will never die. He can just walk right through the battlefield, walk right across the highway, rush hour traffic, doesn't matter. Won't get killed. I'm a devotee. Doesn't mean that. It means unless there's some plan that's a deliberate plan of the Lord, then it won't happen. There's a situation where one of our leaders in ISKCON just got some very tragic news. It's Bhakti Tirtha Swami. You heard the situation? I saw him at the Chicago Rath Yatra at the end of June, last weekend in June. And he led the kirtan 2/3 of the way, dancing, 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 dancing. And then he commented, I don't have the vitality that I used to. My body's getting older. It wasn't just so he went to the Toronto Rath Yatra No, he went to the Washington Rath Yatra, which is the weekend that follows that. Yes, he went to the Toronto Rath Yatra, which is in July. He was, because he was feeling weak, he had some medical checkups. Everything was fine. Everything was fine. Everything was fine. Specifically, he mentioned, they saw him at the Gitanagari Rath Yatra. That was the last weekend in July. He said when he was at the Toronto Rath Yatra, he had some tests. And the tests showed that he had diabetes. Never had diabetes in his life. And 2 weeks before, tests showed he didn't have diabetes. But then, diabetes. And then, because of diabetes, one of the things that happens with diabetes is, if you get a cut, or, you know, the healing processes of the body are depleted. So he had this lump in his foot, and it was painful, and so after dancing and dancing at the Toronto Rath Yatra, he went just to get some, to find out what the problem was. And he said that there's a swelling in your foot, some kind of a growth, that they call that a tumor. Cancer is used as a tumor, but it just means a growth that's increasing in size. So, when you go back to Washington, you should have it checked. When he went back to Washington, they had it checked. It was growing. It was, you know, growing quickly. So, then he went to Gitanagari Rath Yatra and said they're going to have an operation to remove that growth. When they removed the growth, they found that they did a biopsy of the thing, the tumor. And they found, they didn't find any cancer. They did some more checks and they found some cancer, some of the side growths. And it's melanoma cancer, which means it's extremely aggressive cancer, like top of the charts of aggressive cancer. It's traditionally a skin cancer, so it means it passes along the body very quickly. And then they found that it's more tests. They found it's grade 4, which means it's really advanced. It was just in his foot. They were planning to amputate his foot. I mean, the best case scenario was amputate his foot, and it hasn't spread, and they can do something to check it from spreading. They found that it spread throughout his body, and so now it's minimally, it's still amputate his foot, and then they're looking at different possibilities of cancer treatment. This particular kind of cancer has a from 7% to a 12% cure rate. Not likely, and it's in a very advanced stage. So he's now considering, he asked the doctors, if I just did nothing, how long would I have to live? For? Maximum half a year, 6 months. And then he's looking at, from that point, if he did something. And then there are different somethings that he could do, and who can administer them, and what does it subject himself to, and he's a very courageous person. He's seeing that Krishna wants to, if Krishna wants to take him, Krishna's going to take him. Krishna wants to save him. Krishna wants him to be an example, or whatever Krishna wants, it's what Krishna wants. And he's completely surrendered to what Krishna wants. With an amazing sense of humor and levity. But the thing that, one of the things that's so striking to him is how quickly it all happened. It was nothing, and nothing, and then nothing. And then something, and then, you know, it's too late. It's not like he was negligent in checking his health. So any one of us, that could happen, and all of us will happen at some point. We're going along and everything is normal, and in the next moment, we're gone. And there may be a little notice, and there may not be a little notice. It's a harsh dose of reality, but it's reality. So, Maharaj Pariksit, he's defenseless. He's still an embryo within the womb. You know, if he were more advanced in Kali Yuga, they could just have an abortion at such an advanced stage. And there's Supreme Court legislation going, or Supreme Court decisions going on about, is that kind of, and in Congress, bills being considered about what stage can't you perform abortion. Anyway, this was a Brahmastra abortion planned by Ashwatthama, and the Supreme Lord stepped in. Because when he desires to protect, no one can harm. The Lord is all-powerful, and therefore he can both save and kill as he likes. He not only saved, he became visible to his devotee Maharaj Pariksit, even in that awkward position, in the womb of his mother, in a shape just suitable for his vision. A 7-month child, the size of a thumb. While he's the size of a thumb, there's no difference between the thumb-like Vishnu in the womb of Uttara and the full-fledged Narayan in the Vaikuntha Dham, the kingdom of Godhead. Simultaneously, the Lord of Vaikuntha, the first of the Purusha avatars, Mahavishnu, who generates universes, and it enters into the universe, and then it enters into the atom. I mean, just saying those things in that sequence. But if you think of what it doesn't seem so awesome, or inconceivable, or so inconceivable, but inconceivable, in that simultaneously he's generating the universes, and he's entering into the atoms of the universe. He's smaller than the smallest, and he's bigger than the biggest, simultaneously. He's one entity. Simultaneously. It's not, physically, it's not possible. We're in the room, and we're, the room is in us. It doesn't make sense. But that's the Lord's inconceivable potency. Then next he speaks about the Archavigraha. He accepts the form of Archavigraha, just to accept service from his different incapable devotees. Who appears before Maharaj Pariksit in just suitable form, and he appears before the incapable devotees in the Archavigraha form. By the mercy of the Archavigraha, the form of the Lord in material elements, the devotees who are in the material world can easily approach the Lord, although he is not conceivable by the material senses. The Archavigraha is therefore an all-spiritual form to be perceived by the material devotees. Such an Archavigraha of the Lord is never to be considered material. He just got through saying made of material elements, not to be considered material. Here's the explanation. There is no difference between matter and spirit for the Lord. Although there is a gulf of difference between the two in the case of the conditioned living being. For the Lord there is nothing but spiritual existence, and similarly there is nothing except spiritual existence for the pure devotee of the Lord in his intimate relation with the Lord. There's a very interesting description given by Narada Muni in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where he's discussing with Gopal Kumar about deity worship. Narada Muni is a big authority in deity worship. Narada Pancharatra, a whole book on deity worship. Narada is the authority behind it. So he's explaining the meaning to the passages where it's described sometimes, in some places, that those that are simply engaged in deity worship are on the lowest platform of devotional service. The Kanishtha Adhikari includes, characteristically, the description that someone's engaged in deity worship and not more than that. So Narada clarifies those statements because it makes it sound like, well, that's just very low form of Krishna consciousness or devotional service. But Sanatana Goswami, the compiler of this Brihad Bhagavatamrita, he worshipped Madan Mohan, and Rupa Goswami worshipped Radha Govinda, and Jiva Goswami worshipped Radha Damodar. They worshipped their deities. So he reconciles this way. He said that statement should be understood that there are two classifications of deity worship. One is where one sees the deity form, like Prabhupada is describing here. Literally, absolutely non-different. The Lord himself is personally there receiving our worship. And the other is where one doesn't see like that. One sees wood or stone or metal. An image that's a representation of something higher and something higher. There's so many conceptions of that something higher and so many conceptions of the deity and what's appropriate for the deity and the worship of the deity. Sees one who sees in a material way, that's the description, as opposed to the other type of deity worship. The same idea appears in Hari Bhakti Vilas. You know what Hari Bhakti Vilas is? It's a compilation, again by Sanatana Goswami. Actually, it was compiled by my mind is running to some other topics. Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who was very, very expert in deity worship, compiled the procedures of deity worship, but he didn't want it to have his name on it, so he gave it to Sanatana Goswami to compile with one condition, that he not mention his name. Gopal Bhatta Goswami. So, Sanatana Goswami wrote, or provided us with Hari Bhakti Vilas, and it's a manual on Vaishnava Tantra, how to do, it's a how-to manual on all the rituals, deity worship, initiation, sannyas, samskaras, everything, pran pratishtha, all the ceremonial things that we do in our Vaishnava culture. Uh-oh. Don't hurt yourself. So, in that Hari Bhakti Vilas, it describes similarly two different procedures for worship. If, for example, the deity is harmed or broken, so there's a smarter conception, which is this lower conception, and then there's another conception, which is the higher conception is the deity is not different than Krishna. Supposing you have a child that breaks their hand, you throw the child away. You take care of your child. Repair the damage to the child, and you continue caring for them with great affection. That is one procedure. That's in Hari Bhakti Vilas. Another procedure is if the deity is broken, you form another deity and ceremoniously take the broken deity to the river or the ocean, and just like they do it periodically with Lord Jagannath. Or I did this when I was a very new devotee. The Jagannath deities had been damaged. Or one of them. I didn't know because I wasn't there. I was like the second day I was in the temple. I went with Krunamoya, and we went to the Charles River in Boston, and Lady Subhadra was put in a burlap bag, tied to a big rock, and threw the big rock, and Lady Subhadra went straight down to the bottom of the Charles River. They had another Lady Subhadra to take her place. Or it happened in Los Angeles. There was an earthquake. And the deities, Rukmini Dwargadish, were safe, but the Jagannath deities fell when the earthquake happened. And so parts of the bodies of those deities were damaged. And then they had this whole decision. Should they repair the body of the deity, or should they replace the deity? They consulted Hari Bhakti Vilas. And there are these two procedures. And so the procedure depends upon the acharya who indicates it should be this or that procedure. And that the acharya makes that discrimination or that decision or that gives that direction based upon the faith of the individual, based upon their spiritual standing. But Prabhupada was not present when this thing happened, so a council of Brahmins assembled, and what they decided to do in Los Angeles was they maintained the deities for some time. They repaired and maintained, but then later replaced. That was their decision. But there are times when Prabhupada indicated replace, and there are times when Prabhupada indicated repair, depending upon the situation and the devotees involved and so on, their attachment for the deity, their level of consciousness. So at the end of Hari Bhakti Vilas, like the concluding statements is, all of these indications must be performed under the careful direction of a spiritual master. So that this statement is there that Prabhupada would often refer to, that one is considered to be possessed of hellish mentality if they consider the deity to be made of wood, stone, or metal, or if they consider the spiritual master to be an ordinary person. So it's consistent with this Brihat Bhagavatamrita understanding also. Possessed of hellish mentality is very strong language. A more gentle language is to say they're on a lesser level of bhakti. But on that lesser level of bhakti, one can make offenses. And offense to the deities by considering them to be material, that's an offense. It's offensive worship. But still, it's at the beginning stage of bhakti. There's worship of the deity form instead of nothing. But if one wants to advance, one has to get free from that material conception. And how do you get free from that material conception? Just like our discussion from yesterday evening, under the capable guidance of a spiritual master, spiritual teacher. Capable guidance is required. So if one is thinking of the spiritual teacher in a material way, how are you going to get over the material conceptions? You're stuck in a condemned mentality, hellish mentality. So through that passageway, through that channel of having a proper conception of, just as all of you have been so very carefully trained, here's another scriptural reference to help you understand the validity of this. By having a proper regard for your spiritual teacher, you can then get freed from improper conceptions of things, which puts you on the path of the Vyapasayamika Buddhi. If you don't have a proper conception or regard for your spiritual teacher, you're not going to get there. You'll stay in this, you say it gently, in the covered state, or you can say it more strongly, the condemned, hellish mentality state. There's a verse in the Bhagavatam in the 10th canto. It's not the page down to the gate. Kavitralishu Bhoma Ijadi. If one considers one Bhoma Ijadi, if one considers one's place of birth to be worshipable, nationalist spirit. One considers, one goes to a place of pilgrimage and just takes bath without hearing from saintly persons. One's no better than an animal. It goes into the river and takes bath and doesn't hear from saintly persons. Material conceptions. Same as this, what we heard last night. Considering the body to be the self, one's place of birth to be worshipable, go to a sacred place and take a bath without hearing, without using the faculties of higher consciousness. No better than an animal. Animals get benefit from going, taking bath in the Ganges. But there's further benefit to be achieved from this human form of life. And the Lord, the point of this verse is the Lord discloses himself to such devotees. He makes himself manifest in the seat of consciousness out of his kindness and divine mercy.
There's also a detailed question that I wanted to know. But we have also heard that when the child is in the womb, then he prays to Krishna that
So, the premise of your question is important. Say it again.
When the child is in the womb,
Not Maharaj Prikshit, but the child in the womb.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, but that shows a pretty advanced consciousness.
Yes, that's right. That's after the 7 months and they're awake. And it's uncomfortable. That's advanced consciousness. Some who are very fortunate So what's your question?
So what I was thinking is if already he has although it's uncomfortable but he's recognizing that Krishna can free him. But then when he comes into the world, then he feels it's like going backwards.
Yes, it is. Pious people can also go backwards. Overwhelmed by circumstance and sense gratification. It's not surprising you see that happening. from my direct experience, one prominent thing that comes to mind is September 11th, and people got so religious. And after a time, it's business as usual, because the threat is not as immediate, or doesn't appear to be as immediate. But that's only illusion. It's not that the threat is any less immediate. People got really religious. Every street corner in New York, there was some little altar. In certain parks, it was just filled with altars. People worshipping. The Buddhists worshipping next to the Muslim, worshipping next to the Christian, worshipping next to the Jew, and no problems. Harmonizing on the shelter taking of God. Publicly. And what are most people doing at the street corners in New York? They're not praying to God. And the danger's gone and business as usual. But danger brings good out of people. It's not just common. Should be a surprise. Now, impious people aren't going to do that, but pious people, to whatever degree they're pious, they're naturally going to do that. And it's just like instinctual. No one had to give any lessons. Okay, now you should pray to God because there's danger. So it's instinctual. Instinct means it's coming, the prompt is from super soul. Because of his previous life as a very pious king, an elephant began praying to God in danger. It's not what he immediately did, but when he saw it, it's hopeless. Sometimes it takes something like that to happen for each of us. Checkmate. You lose. The game's all over. And if you can accomplish that one thing, then the other things can be accomplished. You think you can do it? You better. When there's a will, there's a way. Always. Actually, there's no obstacle. Except ourselves. Our own self-defeating, envious nature. That's the only reason. There's no real reason. That's not even a real reason. I'll send you, I just sent it to another individual. I'll just send you a little compilation of scriptural statements about teacher-student relationship. But basically, very simply, teacher means spiritual teacher. And spiritual teacher means representing the scriptures. The spiritual conception is transparently, they are a walking scripture. What they speak is what the scripture says, and what they do is what they speak. Or another spiritual conception is like Maharaj Yudhisthira says to Vidura, persons like you are unto themselves a place of pilgrimage. Because you even purify places of pilgrimage. So a spiritual conception is that a teacher is a perambulatory tirtha. As they move, they bring the sanctity that a tirtha brings. When they come to you, so you go to them. A spiritual conception of a teacher is they're carrying spiritual potencies in a basket, a spiritual potency basket, and they distribute it. And Krishna keeps filling it up. And that's what they do. They give. The science of Krishna. By their example, as well as by their words. That's a spiritual conception. What's a proper conception of the, of an embassy? It's the country. It's like in New York City, there's an Indian embassy. So maybe you don't know where that is because you don't have to get a visa, but I know where it is because I have to get a visa. It's just off of Fifth Avenue on 61st Street. And you go there and there's, you know, the laws of India are in force. It's not the laws of America. You go inside the door and it's India. You break the law there, it's you're breaking Indian law. Understand? It's India. Although it's in America. Just leaves that little plot of land. It's legally. It's an embassy. So, it's a spiritual conception of a teacher is they're the ambassador of the scriptures. Which means of Krishna. You receive something from them, you're receiving from Krishna. You give something to them, you're giving to Krishna. Because they're transparent. Not their ideas. It's Krishna's ideas. It's not their gifts, it's Krishna's gifts. And when they receive something, it's not for them. I mean, their transparency tells them this is for Krishna. And it goes to Krishna. That's a spiritual deception. And the varieties of material conceptions are abundant. It's the absence of the spiritual conception covered in different ways. Anything else? Yeah. Don't mix. That the part, let's say Paramatma is in our heart. And so this common question, if there's a heart transplant, does Paramatma move or does the soul move? And Prabhupada would laugh. No. That's a machine, like a part of the machine. But Krishna is situated in that region of the heart, or he's within the atom, but that doesn't mean he's in a container and he's another material thing in a container. You move the container and you move Krishna. He's all pervasive. he's spiritually in his spiritual situation, not in contact with matter. He's within the atom. He's all pervasive. He's between every atom. That depends on one's conception, how one understands something like that. One can certainly think neglect. I've been neglectful, and just like a mother may think towards their child gets hurt. Of course, children are different than Krishna, but I need to be more attentive. I'm lacking in devotion. There may be other reasons, but that's one reason. That's how a devotee can think, at least. Separating us from them, but we're down here, and so we can't do that, and so.
And also, I'm not able to see the intensity of their sacrifice because the fact that they're great.
You don't have any experience of that greatness.
They can do it, so they can do it. So it doesn't bring me that feeling in me that they're doing so much sacrifice.
Is your point, how does that impact on me? Like, you know, how can I take inspiration to also make sacrifice? That doesn't seem to be what you're asking. It's more you're asking how to have proper regard.
How to see that sacrifice properly? Because the fact that they're great, it seems to me that because Krishna is making them make the sacrifice,
because Krishna is making them great, you don't identify the sacrifice with the person. It's Krishna's greatness.
Yeah.
And Krishna is making the sacrifice happen, not them.
Yeah,
but while that's true, it's incomplete. Because Krishna doesn't make anybody do anything. Any more than it's the same mercy that Krishna is bestowing upon that great person, Krishna is offering to each of us. So their greatness is their receptivity, their eagerness for that descending mercy, and their eagerness to distribute that descending mercy also. That's their greatness. They're receiving and they're giving. And sacrifice can have different connotations. One connotation is that you give up something. Generally, people give up something to get something higher. But that something higher, just like we're hearing about Maharaj Yudhisthira, there was no selfish motivation. Why was he doing what he was doing? For the pleasure of Krishna. And while doing for the pleasure of Krishna, others will simultaneously benefit the citizens. So he administered generously. But that was just a subset of his greatness. Yes, it's true, his greatness is a subset of the mercy that he was receiving. But that's part of his greatness. He cared about the citizens. He didn't just care about himself. So there's the relationship that the great person has with Krishna. So it's not just, in other words, like Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in Madhurya Kandambani, in the first chapter, he discusses how does bhakti arise. And if you give the answer, it arises from the causeless mercy of Krishna. Then we would see, if that was the fact, everyone's a devotee. But we don't see that everyone's a devotee. So if greatness of a sacrificing person is just Krishna's mercy, then if that's the only factor, everyone would be great. But we don't see that. So there's something about the individual too that makes for that greatness. It doesn't discount at all the descending mercy of Krishna factor. But there is something special about the person, a great person. Their consciousness, their heart. Again, their eagerness to receive that mercy that Krishna wants to give, and their transparent distribution of that mercy that Krishna has given, which then just replenishes their supply miraculously. Because normally when you give something, you have less. But the great person understands the principle, they're experiencing the principle, the more they give, the more they have. So that realization, that consciousness that they carry, that's part of their greatness. They're not miserly. They give freely. And then you can take it the next step, and they're receiving Krishna's protection. Okay, well, because they're protected, because Krishna protects them. Not because they're brave, because Krishna protects them. But why did Krishna protect them? It's part of their relationship. They're just dependent upon Krishna. That's their greatness. They're not, you know, just in case Krishna forgets me, I've got all my other defenses set up. They don't have that. That's part of their greatness. And you can examine their greatness by seeing if approached with some intimidation, are they going to pick up their weapons? Their psychological, verbal... No. They may act in a decisive manner, but it's for the satisfaction of Krishna, for the service to Krishna purpose. Only. And not otherwise. That's their greatness. So whether it's loving relationship, it's two ways. Anything else? Yes. Say it again.
Regarding developing the spiritual conception of the teacher and
how yeah.
proper regard.
Yeah.
And that's it. Right now I don't have a proper conception of the regard. So I've got out the moment of the process. How do I cultivate the proper conception of the regard? How do I cultivate the regard?
You want to answer his question? Go ahead. Yes, you do. I'm asking you to answer his question. I'll help you as you go along, but I want you to answer the question. His specific question was restoring or gaining proper spiritual conception. So your answer was, even I may not have had a spiritual proper spiritual conception, simply faithfully executing an instruction. And then that's what you did. Now, did that help you regain or spiritualize your conception? Huh? You think so? Okay. Can you describe how that happened? Or what happened? What was the difference between before and after? This gets back to your answer, the way that you've answered the question, or responded to the question, gets back to the discussion from yesterday, the relationship between intelligence and faith. Intelligence, the function of intelligence is to discriminate this thing from that thing. What's what? So, and then faith is what drives, moves us along towards that, being in that consciousness, acting in that consciousness. So when you act in knowledge, then realization comes. And when realization comes, it increases your faith. And with greater faith, I'm ready to go further. So the two actually advance in a tandem fashion. Just like this little, the earlier question of what is a spiritual conception? So one can give a textbook answer to a spiritual conception, but then being situated in that conception, you could get an A in exam, you know how to get A's in exams, and you can give the answer to the question, what's a spiritual conception? And what's a material conception? But then to be situated in that, actually functioning in that consciousness, requires some faith. Then you have to act, I like your answer, you have to act in knowledge. I may be bewildered, I may be fool number one, but I've been gifted with some real understanding. I have no realization of it, I don't have a grasp of it, I'm far from it, but let me act upon it, let me apply it. With as much of a genuine spirit as I can, and some realization will come. You touch electricity and you get a shock. That's electricity. Now let me handle this electricity more carefully. Let me learn more about electricity and handle it more carefully, and I can do more things with it. And I get more realization. Applied spiritual technology. And it helps to confirm the conceptions and be situated within the conceptions. Those proper conceptions and regular hearing combined with regular applying of what one has heard is the method. We won't do that. We will do that to the degree we have faith in the process. To the degree we don't have faith in the process, we can even be exposed to the process and be out to lunch. Defensive. Exposed to the process and offensive. So with faith, with even a modest amount of faith, we need to apply. This is, and then the conceptions will get stronger and clearer. We get some realizations. Now, even with realizations, the tendency is to slide backwards. But if there's sincerity, a little faith and some sincerity, we keep going. Even we get pulled back into the material conceptions. Step by step. Okay. And there, to the fellow time. Right. Thank you.
Buddha.